The history of redlining is one increasingly well known within and beyond the academy. In the 1930s, as part of an attempt to shore up the struggling economy by underwriting home mortgages, the government's Home Owners Loan Corporation, or HULC, developed a series of guidelines and criteria for assessing the risk of lending in urban areas. HULC criteria drew heavily on the racial logics employed by lenders, developers, and real estate appraisers. Thus, A-rated neighborhoods, those associated with the least risk for banks and mortgage lenders, tended to be exclusively white, while D-rated areas, deemed the most risky, included large numbers of Black and/or other non-white residents. These neighborhoods were color-coded red on HULC maps, hence the term redlining, and they were often denied home loans. HULC and redlining had a dramatic effect on American cities, with consequences lasting to the present day. Yet the image of the HULC color-coded maps suggests a more static relationship between lending and urban America than actually existed. In today's episode, Rebecca Marshall tells a more complex and nuanced story of white and Black community activists who engaged with the federal government and banks in an effort to expose redlining in its multiple forms and to imprint their own financial common sense on banking. In doing so, she undercuts notions that the reality depicted in HULC's maps was set in stone by the 1960s, when residents in Chicago's West Side first became suspicious that they had become victims of redlining, while at the same time revealing the alternative models of financing proposed by community activists in the urban reinvestment movement. You are listening to Who Makes Sense, a History of Capitalism podcast. I'm Jessica Levy. Who Makes Sense is a monthly podcast devoted to bringing you engaging stories that explain how capitalism has changed over time. We interview historians as well as social and cultural critics about capitalism's past, highlighting the political and the economic changes that have created the present. You can support our show by donating at patreon.com/whomakessense. Today, I'm speaking with Rebecca Marshall.
My name is Rebecca Marshall, and I am an assistant professor of history at the University of Mississippi.
Welcome to the show. I really enjoyed reading this book. It taught me a lot about the history of banking and housing in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. In other words, the decades after redlining. For those that haven't had a chance to read it yet, can you give us a brief introduction to the book? What's it about?
Sure. Well, first, thank you so much for having me on one of my favorite podcasts. I'm really excited to be here. So the book is about a social movement of low and moderate income urbanites living in neighborhoods that were usually racially changing, usually from majority white to integrated. And the book follows these urbanites as they become politicized, as they start organizing. They realize that when their neighborhoods started to change demographically, that they also seem to lose access to their local banks for things like mortgages and home improvement loans. And this, as we know, is redlining, right? When banks don't make fair loans to certain neighborhoods because people of color live there. So the book follows these activists as they build a social movement for what they called urban reinvestment. And as they understood that term, they defined it rather capaciously, right, as public spending and bank-based lending that would help revitalize redlined neighborhoods. But I also see the book as a story about the way that banks were changing during the last third of the 20th century, right? As activists were pressuring banks to reinvest in their neighborhoods, they were sort of aiming at a moving target. These activists really expected banks to kind of behave like George Bailey's bank and It's a Wonderful Life, right? These local institutions, stewards of local wealth, they take so-and-so's savings and put it in someone else's home. But this was a period when savings and loans, the banks that are most like George Bailey's bank, were really struggling to survive. It was an era of inflation, of increased competition from other commercial banks, from other kinds of financial institutions. And so as activists are trying to enlist banks to reinvest in their neighborhoods, this is really a time when George Bailey's bank is going out of style, right? It stops matching the reality of what's actually happening for savings and loans.
Yeah, I think I was surprised coming into the book. At first, I was like, oh, okay, this is a social movement story. And I was like, oh, I'm learning so much about banks and banking. So how did you get into this topic?
I definitely did not start this project thinking that I was going to be writing so much about banks or have to understand things about banks. So when I was trying to decide on a dissertation topic, it just so happened to be the summer and then the fall of 2008. And so everyone was talking about subprime mortgages and mortgage-backed securities and bailouts and all this kind of stuff. And I was out for a run listening to the Planet Money podcast, and I heard a lobbyist from one of the financial trade associations, I can't remember which one at this point, but he said that there was this 1977 law called the Community Reinvestment Act that was largely responsible for all this subprime lending and for the mortgage crisis. And at that point, I actually stopped running. Like, I stopped in my tracks as my jaw kind of hit the floor, because I knew about this law, the Community Reinvestment Act, which I'll talk about a bunch, I'm sure. I knew about that law already because I'd worked in nonprofits. And so I learned about the Community Reinvestment Act because that law was really helpful for fundraising at nonprofits, right? We could get banks to give us money for programs like asset-based development and children's savings accounts and that kind of thing. But that law definitely did not bring down the global economy. I knew that from my work at nonprofits. So when I got back home, like before I even could pour a glass of water, I sat down at my computer and started searching library databases to see if anyone had written the origin story of the CRA. And there's some really great work by sociologists and urban scholars and legal scholars. Dan Immergluck, especially, his work was super helpful for making sense of what was going on here. But no historians had yet written the story I imagine, right? Like attention to context and change over time and structure and agency and that kind of thing. So I started digging and then realized there was this social movement behind the CRA. And I actually had a friend at the time who worked for People's Action. That's what this group is called now. It was National People's Action, but now it's just People's Action. So I sent my friend a note to say, do you know if there are any papers at your workplace? So he put me in touch with the executive director, a guy named George Gale, and they gave me unlimited access to what became known in my mind as the basement, right? It was just like, I think it was either 10 or 12 filing cabinets that were just full of unorganized, unprocessed papers, which could either be a historian's dream or nightmare, but for me, it was a dream. So newsletters, speeches, photos, memos, meeting agendas, just all this really rich stuff that helped me piece the story together.
That's really wonderful. And also to think about the ways that your pre-grad school life intersected with academic and scholarly life.
Mm-hmm. Very grateful for that too.
So the book is set in the late 20th century urban America, specifically older neighborhoods like Austin, Chicago. Can you set the stage for us? What was going on in these urban neighborhoods that animated local residents like Gale, Sinkota, and Sheltrap, two of the central protagonists in your book? And please correct me if I'm mispronouncing their names.
Yeah, so it's Gale, Sinkota, and Sheltrap. So your listeners might be familiar with the process in urban neighborhoods at this time. That's called blockbusting or panic peddling. And I'll explain that briefly because that's really important to understand where the story begins. So in many all-white neighborhoods that were beginning to integrate, real estate speculators would come in and scare white people into selling their homes for cheap. They would draw on this common assumption among white homeowners, among folks in the real estate industry, right, that the presence of any neighbors of color would bring down the home values in the neighborhood. And then they'd sell those same homes at higher prices to Black buyers. On the logic of segregated housing markets, the reality for Black buyers was that they had fewer options. And so logic of supply and demand and the reality of sometimes desperation meant they would pay more for decent housing. So these speculators would make a pretty hefty profit, right, in the process of doing that. So folks in Austin saw this happening, white residents who'd lived there already, Black residents who were moving in, and they were trying to stop the panic peddlers themselves. They were trying to protest, trying to change local ordinances to make it difficult for those folks to work in their neighborhoods. And they also experimented in what you might call managed integration, right? That they tried to help white families buy in the parts of Austin where these panic peddlers were usually steering black buyers, right? So they tried to get white families in those neighborhoods instead, and then also try to steer black families into white neighborhoods in Austin or the white suburb nearby Oak Park, right? A place where panic peddlers wouldn't usually let black buyers even look at houses. So, right, walking a really fine line there and doing some racial steering themselves. But activists soon found themselves saying, hey, you know, when white families bought homes in these neighborhoods before, they usually went to the bank and got a mortgage. But now there seems to be these sort of unregulated mortgage houses that are usually part of these panic sales. So what's going on here? So they start paying attention to the financing that's related to blockbusting and panic peddling.
Following her actors, this is where Rebecca too begins digging more into the history of home financing.
And here the archival record is unfortunately a bit thin. I was desperately hoping I could figure out exactly how these organizers in Austin started paying attention to banks, right? And I imagine maybe a member of the group tried to get a home improvement loan and was turned down, or maybe they just noticed that nobody was using the banks anymore. But in any case, they realized that their local banks really weren't issuing many mortgages in the neighborhood anymore, and that the panic peddling sort of seemed to replace the usual home buying process in general. And so that from there, they kind of start to investigate local banks. They notice that things have changed. And they notice that the timing of the change seems to map very tidily onto the moment of racial integration.
So one of the ways in which these activists come together is through this Organization for a Better Austin. And, you know, I think this story you tell about managed integration is really interesting, seemingly forging unique multiracial working class coalition. Can you describe a little bit more this process, you know, how it is that white organizers attracted African Americans and built this multiracial coalition?
Yes. So I was lucky enough to interview a few of the organizers to get a sense of the strategies that they've made up as they went along to try to build this interracial organization. And they realized that it might be difficult to get white buy-in at this moment when there was such resentment by whites who were selling their homes for cheap. A lot of folks had already left the neighborhood. So in one instance, one of them told me a story about how they called a meeting for, let's say, 6 o'clock, right? But they told black members of the organization to show up earlier, let's say 5:45. So then when white folks that they'd asked to join this organization showed up at six, they saw a room full of their black neighbors. And so it became a sort of self-selected group, right? White Austinites who were not interested in interracial organizing would just go home, right? Whereas those who were interested would stay. There was another case where they decided to send their sort of most eager organizers into the areas of Austin where black neighbors were moving in, recognizing that in a lot of the white neighborhoods, there are already sort of existing institutions like, you know, Catholic churches, some block clubs and that kind of thing. But where black residents were moving in, they had not yet built those kinds of organizations to structure the social fabric of their community there. So the most eager organizers would go down there and build block clubs from scratch. And they also had this, the organizers had this way of thinking about self-interest that came out of Alinsky-style organizing. And so the line was sort of thinking about how to connect neighborhoods around their self-interest and their shared self-interest. So white neighbors and black neighbors all had an interest in making the neighborhood a good place to live. And the organizers were supposed to focus on that rather than, for example, trying to convince white people not to be racist, right? The strategy was to steer clear of some of those larger questions about morality, racial justice, fighting white supremacy, and instead focus on pragmatic questions like, how do we make this neighborhood a good place to live? And folks found a lot of common ground in the idea that panic peddlers did not make a place a good place to live.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking of those kind of practical, how do we make this neighborhood work? As you mentioned before, this eventually leads them to thinking about finance and banking. And so many of the arguments that get made by community activists rooted in a financial relationship between residents and their neighborhood savings and loans, or as you say, thrifts. And as you mentioned, this relationship was so ingrained that you refer to it as financial common sense to activists. So can you tell us a little bit more about this financial common sense and some of the obstacles that emerged to challenge it?
Sure. So when I use that phrase, financial common sense, in the book, I'm referring to a set of ideas that many Americans had about how banks worked and how banks ought to behave. And those ideas were formed during an era in which banking was really shaped by laws and regulations created in response to the Great Depression and the New Deal. So for most folks, ideas about banks were really ideas about savings and loans, right? Those institutions were sort of noisiest in people's minds because usually those were the kinds of institutions that Americans in the mid-20th century had some kind of relationship to. These institutions largely served white people, but there is also a really rich history of Black savings and loans and Black mutual aids too. But this is another instance in which a lot of these sort of New Deal rights and programs are rather racially specific. But savings and loans were the institutions that Americans of modest means could use to save their money, right? It was almost as safe as shoving your money under a mattress, but because it had federal deposit insurance, but it was even better than that because you could get a little bit of interest on your passbook account. And then savings and loans were also the institutions that white Americans relied on most often to finance homeownership. Savings and loans made up the lion's share of mortgages during the post-World War II period. And so people had these relationships with thrifts.
This is something that, as a historian, took me a bit off guard because the narrative that has developed around post-war home mortgages put so much emphasis on the Federal Housing Administration.
One thing that I actually found surprising in the research was learning that it was really conventional loans and not FHA-insured loans that really drove the post-war expansion of homeownership, right? So we have this sort of expectation, because we know how important the FHA was to changing the business of lending, right? The assumption is that when you see this jump in homeownership post-World War II, that the FHA is responsible for that too. But it's actually conventional loans, right? Meaning loans without FHA insurance that drove that expansion and supplied an estimated 2/3 of suburban mortgages during the period after World War II. And so when activists start to get upset about how they want their banks to lend more, they actually want conventional loans, because the FHA loans, as Kianga Taylor's book shows us, were a pretty bad deal, right? They often covered shoddy housing and, you know, had all these problems. It's also the case that an FHA loan was usually going to be sold off to an investor. And activists saw this as a bad deal too, because they wanted their banks to hold on to their mortgages, right? And to have a long-term interest in that person paying back that loan.
And they wanted these conventional loans, as Rebecca mentions, to come from their local savings and loans, or thrift.
People had these relationships with thrifts before this era of ATMs and online banking. When you wanted to deposit your paycheck, you would go to the thrift and put it into your passbook account. When you went to pay your mortgage, if you didn't want to put that pretty giant check in the mail, you might actually go into the savings and loan and pay it in the building. Right? So people had sort of a regular interaction with these institutions. And then there's also the reality that these institutions were created by federal regulations to facilitate homeownership, right? So it's not just people's relationships with these institutions, but also that the government had created laws and policies that made savings and loans these particular kinds of institutions. And so by this logic, there's a sense that savings and loans were special kinds of businesses, right? They're not just profit-seeking firms. They were firms, they were businesses that were supposed to prioritize community service. They were stewards of local savings. They were invested in the future of the community. They were part of the fabric of a community. And I should say that It's a Wonderful Life really does deserve some credit for these ideas, right? There's a sort of oversimplified vision of banking in which, you know, customers are all connected because their savings become loans. That's not exactly how banks work. But right, this vision that becomes part of American culture in the 20th century, we can see Frank Capra is responsible for some of that too. But thrifts also sold this idea back to the public, right? This idea that they were service-oriented, that they were part of the community. Their marketing, their institutional histories, their industry newsletters, they all emphasized service and community and neighborhoods. And they'd often name themselves after the neighborhood in which they were located, or they'd name themselves after a big street that was running through the neighborhood, doubling down on the idea that this is a community institution. So this idea that thrifts are not just profit-generating institutions, they're really part of the social fabric of a community and should serve the neighborhood in which it's located. And that's sort of what I mean by financial common sense.
Yeah, so the book is titled After Redlining, the Urban Reinvestment Movement in the Era of Financial Deregulation. And, you know, thanks to historians like David Freund and projects like Mapping Inequality, redlining has garnered significant attention within and beyond the academy. Many, including me, before reading this book, associate redlining with the FHA maps made in the 1930s, those images that many urban historians now have ingrained in their minds. And yet over time, the activists that you discuss, as they struggle to understand why their financial common sense isn't working or is it doesn't seem to match reality anymore, came to understand redlining as something, you know, much more expansive than the traditional story about FHA and the FHA maps. And so can you elaborate a little bit on their understanding of redlining?
So I actually found from the, I think it was 1974, there was a document in which activists defined redlining as having 11 different parts, right? So it's not just the idea that banks would not lend in certain neighborhoods. It was other kinds of unequal access to fair credit, right? So banks, they found, sometimes demanded higher down payments in their neighborhoods, right? Which isn't necessarily a loan denial, but it is something that made it harder for a person who wanted to buy a home in their neighborhood, made it harder for them to afford homeownership. So higher down payments, sometimes higher interest rates on the loan, sometimes higher closing costs. They noticed from their connections with activists around the country that this was a pattern that emerged too, that folks would have to pay higher closing costs if they wanted to buy a house in certain neighborhoods. Loans would often have shorter payback periods instead of that 30-year fixed rate mortgage that we associate with the New Deal also. They might have to pay it back in 10 or 15 years if they wanted the loan. And banks would also sometimes set policies that didn't necessarily say we won't lend in that neighborhood, but instead might say we won't lend on homes that were built before 1950 in neighborhoods where most of the homes or all the homes were built before 1950. That is essentially ruling out mortgages in their neighborhood. Or we won't lend on homes that are valued at less than $15,000, right? Not worth our time to deal with those kinds of properties. And again, you'd write out swaths of the city by setting those kinds of regulations. They also found that urbanites in transitional neighborhoods could experience delayed appraisals. An appraisal is an important part of the home buying process, right? This has to be done before you get to that moment of closing on the house. So sometimes appraisals would be delayed, and activists were really suspicious that delayed appraisals were a scam to slow down the process such that buyers would eventually just give up and walk away from pursuing buying that property. Sometimes low appraisals they saw as another form of redlining too, right? Where an appraiser would bring their own biases about the neighborhood into the appraisal process and say that house is not worth very much. Whereas an activist would say, it's a good house, you just don't like where it's located. So basically, whenever loans seem to be unreasonable compared to how banks were treating white neighborhoods or white suburbs, then activists identified that as a form of redlining.
So one of the things that's really interesting is you talk about the Alinsky method of organizing and the importance of local organizing. But eventually, because of the ways that banking is national and tied to the federal government, activists realize that they have to take their organizing to the national level, and they form the National People's Action on Housing, or NPAH. Through NPAH and other organizations, community activists took their fight for reinvestment to Washington in an attempt to influence policy. And, you know, it's kind of amazing in the sense that they do influence policy, as you show. So can you tell us about some of these victories, including with regards to disclosure?
Sure. So the first one that comes to mind is when activists sought to reform the FHA's urban lending program, which is right the subject of Kianga Yamada Taylor's award-winning book, Race for Profit. But FHA loans at this time tended to be exploitative in that oftentimes the FHA was insuring loans to home buyers, low-income home buyers who would purchase shoddy structures without knowledge of the home's problems and then would be stuck with the cost of bringing that home up to code to make it livable. This was a giant problem in these neighborhoods. And so activists organized to try to reform the FHA programs. They identify an ally in Congress, Adlai Stevenson of Illinois, who knew about FHA abuses. And he actually sponsors legislation that leads to federal paybacks for people who bought these FHA houses, right? And that there's a point when a congressional staffer really says it was these activists who turned this idea into policy. But maybe more important than that is the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act of 1975. So this was a law that activists apparently helped to craft on the floor at an organizer conference in the mid-1970s, although that document is lost, which is very sad to me. But the idea was to force depository banks, so that's thrifts and commercial banks, the banks that hold people's savings accounts, force those banks to disclose the geographic location of where they made their loans. And this was a really big deal for activists because before this time, you know, ordinary people did not have access to this information about where banks made their loans. And if you think about it, these activists had been saying there's redlining in our neighborhoods, right? Banks won't make loans here. But then they had no meaningful data to back up this charge, right? They had anecdotes of folks not getting mortgages. They could point to panic peddlers and say, you know, this doesn't look right, but they didn't have data. So the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act says to banks, you have to disclose your lending patterns, right? You have to give to the public information about where you make your loans. And that information was really helpful to activists so they could actually start to document discriminatory lending patterns that before they were only describing as anecdotes. And I'll mention one more federal victory, national level victory, which was the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977, right? That law that made me, you know, stop running in 2008. But that law really passed in large part because of an ally in the Senate, William Proxmire of Wisconsin. And he sort of had this vision building on the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, which HMDA is more fun to say. That's what they call it. So he built on HMDA and said, you have all these activists who know where banks are making loans. They're all organized. You could hold banks more accountable if they had some standing to use that data and challenge the banks. And so that's basically what the CRA did, right? It created this opportunity for activists, for community groups to have some standing to challenge banks. And the way it worked was if a bank was going to merge or acquire another bank, then community groups had the standing to file what was called a CRA challenge. And if they filed a CRA challenge with a federal banking regulator, they could stall that merger or acquisition if one or more of the banks in question could be said to be not responsive to local lending needs. And so in the book, I talk about the CRA as empowering activists as kind of grassroots financial regulators. Right now, they are using HMDA data and have the standing to stall these business deals. And in the long run, it creates a tool for activists to create community bank partnerships that enlist some banks into more lending agreements with previous redline neighborhoods. But I think we'll talk more about those partnerships later on.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of creating a bunch of young Elizabeth Warrens, you know, community banking regulation. So as you say, these victories are really important, especially kind of thinking about disclosure and empowering communities to have some say in banking, in both understanding where they're lending, what they're doing, but also into having some say and to regulate those. But they're also not without their limitations. Both the Disclosure Act and the CRA leave a lot of leeway to banks. And you talk about this as a financial turn in urban policy.
So it's important context to think about the late 1970s as a moment of economic downturn when the Carter administration, Democrats in Congress, right, had to figure out how to navigate high unemployment, high inflation. There's a sort of shift towards austerity and domestic policy, but they still want to show that they care about the problems of the cities, right? So I look at sort of three federal initiatives from this era and put them in conversation together to think about what they had in common, right? The Community Reinvestment Act, the Urban Development Action Grant Program out of HUD, and then the Community Investment Fund that comes out of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, which is the regulator of the savings and loans, right, the George Bailey banks. And what those three programs had in common was that they're all based on this premise that financial institutions would play a big role in revitalizing American cities, right? That finance would in large part replace federal funding, replace direct federal spending in urban redevelopment projects. So I already talked about the CRA, but the UDAGs, right, the Urban Development Action Grants, there's a shift in thinking about the role of federal funding in this program, and that the purpose of federal funding was basically just to recruit private financing to urban redevelopment. So the idea was that these small federal grants, that's the G and UDAG, supposed to be seed money, that would be important leverage, right? Those are the kind of buzzwords. But they're supposed to encourage private investors to fund urban projects. And so the UDAGs are sort of framed as a public good because they're projects that are supposed to create jobs, to revitalize cities. There's this social purpose that justifies the small federal grants. But the expectation is that the bulk of the money for these urban development projects is supposed to come from private financing. And so a lot of hotels that we stay in when we go to conferences, or when we used to before COVID, a lot of those have their root in UDAG projects. But the other one that I talk about, the FHLBB, the RIFT regulator, is this community investment fund, which was established in the late 70s. And it was a $10 billion pool that was supposed to make it easier and cheaper for savings and loans to lend in urban neighborhoods. So the emphasis here was really on urban lending in general, rather than lending to low and moderate income people specifically. And so as I read that initiative, it seemed like the FHLBB was trying to show that savings and loans could meet urban credit needs without more regulations like HMDA and the CRA. Like, we don't need more rules. We can just do this. And we have initiatives here. The activists really saw this program, the CIF, as a what they called a puff job from square one. And I think they had reason to be suspicious, right? The regulations were not very strong here. A thrift could receive money from that $10 billion pool without having to do very much. And so over the first 2 years of the program, there were only between, and it's like about 10% of all the savings and loans in the country actually applied to use the fund. For those who did use the funds, they had a ton of freedom. There was no reason why a participating savings and loan couldn't, you know, show their interest in reinvestment and get some of this CIF money, and then at the same time serve more affluent urbanites in a way that might actually erase reinvestment gains for low and moderate income people. So by the first year, you see the savings and loans using this CIF money to do things like finance condo conversions, finance shopping center renovations. There was one instance of using CIF money toward the rehabilitation of a Long Beach resort hotel. So there's not a tidy alignment between this language of investment and reinvestment and actually helping low and moderate income people. So as I read it, the combination of the CRA, the UDAGs, and the CIF fund really showed a trend in federal policy that seemed to be responding to charges of redlining, right? Saying, yes, banks need to do more in cities. Banks should finance urban redevelopment. But these programs don't actually have enough strings attached to really constitute some kind of repair for red line neighborhoods. And they also, right, they also do that without significant increases in federal spending, which was really important for the Democrats in Congress and the Carter administration.
Yeah. There's a really interesting way in which this parallels the story of corporate social responsibility, which is happening at this same time. Mm-hmm. And thinking about my own research of how businesses are responding to civil rights and other activism, pushing for them to become more engaged, but without very little oversight. Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, all of this is happening without federal funding, but also pushed towards deregulation. Can you tell us about the broader transformation that's going on in banking towards deregulation, including its consequences for savings and loans?
So the financial common sense that I talked about earlier was really rooted in Depression era financial regulations that created thrifts, especially, to be these mortgage granting institutions focused on service. So there were rules and regulations put in place to make this possible. One that was really important was a rule called Regulation Q, which was a cap on interest rates. It was supposed to keep banks from getting involved in bidding wars. This financial regime, right, the New Deal financial regime, also included a charter process that encouraged limited monopolies for savings and loans. And so that means if a person wanted to open a new savings and loans, they had to show that the location they chose actually needed the services and wasn't already being served well by a different savings and loan. So there are these regulations in place that create the conditions for activists to develop their financial common sense. And then what we see in this story is the way those regulations disappear, right? The story of deregulation. So already by the mid-60s, the New Deal financial regime was starting to strain, right? There was a global credit crunch in 1966. It pushed interest rates up in the US, and that really mattered for this story because it pushed interest rates past that regulation Q, right? The cap on interest rates. And so a lot of savers at that time realized they could get higher interest rates if they took their money out of the thrift and put it someplace else, like a securities market that would pay more interest. And so this creates a crisis for thrifts, right? It's called disintermediation, the idea that they'd lose all this money from the savings account side of their balance sheet. And this threat, right, that high interest rates were going to tank thrifts was one that stays throughout the 1970s. It's a period of economic instability, inflation, high interest rates, right? And so there's a recognition that thrift's business model is in deep trouble in this kind of climate, right? They can't pay high rates on savings accounts because they're regulated. At the same time, on the mortgage side of their business, a lot of thrifts are locked into 30-year fixed rate mortgages. And they're locked in to mortgages that borrowers took out when interest rates were lower. So at a time of high interest rates, they can't renegotiate those mortgages, right? They're losing the opportunity to earn more interest on mortgages. So policymakers throughout the 1970s are grappling with this question, like, what do we do about thrifts? And so you see from some commercial bankers, some free market enthusiasts, they start calling for deregulation already in the early 1970s. They're saying these New Deal era regulations are antiquated. They don't fit the 1970s challenges. Let's lift the rules. Let thrifts play more freely. Let them have more powers to behave more like commercial banks, and maybe they can weather the storm this way. That proposal was too radical for a lot of policymakers at the time, right? Not interested in that. A lot of those folks had their own financial common sense, right? Thrifts are supposed to take your savings and make mortgages. But by the late 1970s, the deregulationists really have their moment. And in large part, it's because the context had changed, right? There was a new momentum behind deregulation because at this point, right, you'd had almost a decade, right, of high inflation, of high interest rates, of instability. And people are ready for a new experiment because nothing seemed to be working then. So you see the passage of two laws. There's the Depository Institutions Deregulation and Monetary Control Act of 1979, and also the Garnes-St. Germain Act of 1982. And those two laws together really mark the beginning of meaningful deregulation. And this has huge implications for thrifts, right? It gave them new powers to enter arenas of business that they hadn't been in before, right? New sort of consumer loans, new mortgage products where interest rates were allowed to change. They also were trying to offer savers more competitive vehicles to earn higher interest. And so a lot of these new products were things that thrifts did not have expertise in. So many of them, to be fair, really responded with caution, but the headlines throughout the 80s were really about the reckless thrifts who were wheeling and dealing and exploiting these new permissions. But the long and short of it, right, it's like by the time you get to the late 1980s, it becomes apparent that these new permissions didn't help thrifts navigate the new economic reality of the 70s, right? Many merged, many were acquired, many tanked in the savings and loan crisis. But this really, as I see it, marked the end of that New Deal financial regime and the special role of thrifts as community institutions within it.
So all of this comes to a head, as you mentioned, in the late 1970s and 1980s, both, you know, towards the end of the Carter administration and then obviously under Reagan. And what you describe as the federal government's increasingly intervening on behalf of, quote unquote, small savers over the needs of urban borrowers. And yet, as you show, despite these changes, which overall are negative both for savings and loans and the community activists who really relied and were trying to get back to this New Deal era of financial common sense, the activists continue to evolve, and they learn, you know, ways to use the new limited tools available to them to forge partnerships with banks to keep finance flowing, however limited, to their neighborhoods. What you talk about is the kind of community bank partnership moment. Can you elaborate on these partnerships?
Sure. So the CRA is a really crucial part of this story. So there is a central irony built into that legislation that said when banks are merging or acquiring each other, that's when the CRA is triggered, right? That activists can use that moment to file a challenge. So this movement towards industry consolidation that happens once deregulation opens the space to do that really creates the opportunity for activists to issue these CRA challenges. So what we see over the course of the 80s, like from 1980 until 1994, this is a merger wave. About 6,300 banks merge during that period. And when that happens, there's an opportunity for a community group to file a CRA challenge. But to be clear, activists were not excited about these mergers in general, right? That they were aware that mergers and acquisitions could bode poorly for their neighborhoods, right? This was, they liked neighborhood banking and community banking. So they recognized there was this threat of giant banks replacing neighborhood institutions, but they made the most with what they had. So these reinvestment activists end up issuing these CRA challenges and sometimes just threatening to file a CRA challenge in order to get banks to sit down with them and negotiate some kind of agreement, right? A community bank partnership. And so a good example was in 1983, the First National Bank of Chicago was going to acquire another Chicago bank. And so the organizers in Chicago, they researched the lending record, they used HMDA data, they invited a coalition of neighborhood groups to come together and share testimony about their own experiences with this First National Bank. And so they used that information, took it to First National Bank and said, we're going to file a CRA challenge unless you sit down and work out some agreement with us. And so that's what happened, right? It led to negotiations that took place over 2 months with the bank saying, okay, let's work something out so you don't issue a formal CRA challenge and slow down this acquisition. And so the community groups take bankers on tours of the neighborhood, try to educate them on the impact of unfair access to good credit, also sort of giving them a sense that people call these neighborhoods home and they need access to resources. And so the bank, under this threat of the CRA challenge, agreed to a $100 million loan deal, they called the Special Loan Program, that targeted underserved markets, which they defined as at or below 75% of median household income. And so this special loan program included 30-year fixed rate mortgages on buildings that were mixed use and also on apartment buildings, since activists, they pointed out that their neighborhoods had a lot of mixed use buildings and a lot of apartment buildings, yet First National tended to only lend on single family homes, right? So that specific agreement to get mortgages on those kinds of buildings was a really significant victory. And over the next 3 years, the loans on those kinds of buildings actually doubled in the neighborhoods that they targeted. The agreement also created a permanent neighborhood banking division inside the bank, along with staff whose job was to deal particularly with lending in targeted neighborhoods. I talked to this really dynamic banker named Kristen Faust, who still in this business, right? It's community development banking has really become her life's work. But she talked about how important she saw her position in this neighborhood banking division, that, you know, when someone submitted a mortgage application that went up to snuff, her approach was not to say no, it was to say, here's what it takes to get a yes, right? And that's a big shift from how banks had approached redline neighborhoods just a decade prior. So these community bank partnerships really helped bring some affordable lines of credit into previously redline neighborhoods that helped with affordable housing developments and that kind of thing. But, you know, I'm also careful to say in the book that these partnerships also had their limits, and activists really recognize that as well, right? So, you know, to file a CRA challenge would mean that a neighborhood had to have a community group that was paying attention to local bank mergers, right? And a community group that knew how to use the CRA. So, you know, those partnerships only worked for folks who knew how to win them. And, you know, just zooming out even further, community bank partnerships were a narrow victory in the context of what these activists originally wanted, which was not just bank-based reinvestment, right? It was this broader vision of reinvestment that included significant federal funding and programming to serve low and moderate income communities. Banks were not going to be a silver bullet here.
And on that note, I want to thank Rebecca for taking the time to speak with us. Her work not only sheds light on the history of banking in late 20th century America, but offers us some pointed examples of when and where things might have turned out differently if only activists and local residents had been given a greater voice in the financial decisions impacting their communities. And I want to thank you for listening. I highly recommend picking up a copy of After Redlining, The Urban Reinvestment Movement in the Era of Financial Deregulation. If you like the show, make sure to check us out at whomakessensepodcast.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/whomakessense and follow us on Twitter at whomakessense. You can also learn more about Rebecca's work at our website, whomakessensepodcast.com. And we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. That helps us find more listeners who can enjoy the show. Join us next month for more Histories of Capitalism.